about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Gary Borger, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the angler as predator. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of the program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Gary Borger about the angler as predator. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the support that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Gary, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For a drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Gary's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Gary's latest book, The Angler as Predator. Here's how you can win Gary's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something that Gary and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll be the lucky winner that wins The Angler as Predator. Tonight our guest is Gary Borger. Gary has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Wisconsin campus in Wausau, where he taught for 28 years. He was presented with the Teacher of the Year Award on two different occasions. Gary is one of the world's foremost fly fishing educators. He's been a fly fisher since 1955, and since 1972 has taught classes and lectured internationally in all aspects of fly fishing for trout and salmon. A freelance writer and photographer and an active member of the Outdoor Writers Association of America, Gary is also Midwest Field Editor of Fly Fisherman Magazine, Editor-at-Large for the Virtual Fly Shop, and fly fishing columnist for North American Fly Fisher. He has written five best-selling books on fly fishing, including Nymphing, Naturals, The Borger Color System, Designing Trout Flies, and Presentation, as well as Fishing the Film, Reading Waters, Long Flies, and his latest, The Angler as Predator, which are part of a 20 planned titles in his fly fishing series. Gary pioneered fly fishing video instruction with his release of Nymphing in 1982, and since then has appeared in four videos for 3M Company. In cooperation with the Federation of Fly Fishers, he's produced environmental video, Where the Trout Are. And his video production company has produced an additional 17 internationally acclaimed videos in the Skills of Fly Fishing series. In addition, he's also appeared in TV productions on ESPN and OLM. Gary is also a consultant on Robert Redford's movie, A River Runs Through It. Well, Gary, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be back.
You've got so many darn accomplishments, you know, I could use 90 minutes just for those, you know.
So. Well, I have two clones that do all this other work.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It sounds like you need them for all the things that you get done, I'll tell you. But, well, we've got an interesting topic here tonight, and I'm really anxious to dive into this. It's trout as, I mean, not trout, angler
well,
as predator. If the trout become predators, we're in big trouble, huh? They're going to be some monster trout.
That's
for
right.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So you just finished up this book as a part of your series, Volume 4, mm-hmm. And what do we got then? 16 more to look forward to, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it's going to be exciting. It's going to be quite the library and quite the legacy that you leave for the fly fishing world. And I'm sure everybody really, really appreciates it. Well, let's just dive right in here. And, you know, what? First of all, why should we think of ourselves as predators when we're fly fishing? I thought we were just out there having fun.
Well, I think probably the easiest answer is because we are. You know, we somehow, as humans, assign to the fish qualities and characteristics that it doesn't have. And probably beginning in the 1950s, about 1956, when the state of Michigan introduced the concept of catch and release, the idea that somehow the trout is a worthy opponent and it's more like now a game of chess in which we're playing with another opponent who's playing the same game we are. In actuality, the fish knows nothing about fly fishing. We're the ones that made up fly fishing, not the fish. To the fish, our goal is to catch and kill and eat. That's their, you know, that's the way they understand it. We understand it differently, of course, because we just want to catch them and kiss them and get their photos and put them back again. But that's the game we play. And so if we want to play this game on the same level that the fish's life, you know, has evolved to function, we got to play it actually as a predator. Because they're not treating us like an opponent, they're treating us like a predator. So when they
right.
see us, when we throw the line on the water too hard, when the rod flash flashes across them, so on, they don't assume that we're an angler out to catch them and have fun. They assume we're a predator out to kill them and eat them. So immediately they're gone. So we need to understand how the fish reacts to us as a predator so that we can better tune ourselves as that predator to take advantage of the things that the fish doesn't see or hear, and make it easier for us, therefore, to catch fish.
I guess the more we start thinking like a predator, the better we'll become. And I guess a lot of us maybe just treat fly fishing as more of a, you know, kind of not so seriously. Like I said before, we're just out there to have fun. But if you do it that way, you'll be a lot less successful, right?
Really, yeah, you know, I think we ought to, right up front, I ought to say that I'm not against anybody having any kind of fun they want to have when they're fly fishing. You know, I have good friends that do nothing but fish dry flies. And if they're fishing dry flies in the middle of March and there's no trout ever going to rise, they don't care. On the other hand, you know, on the other hand, I have guys that only want to fish with streamer flies. So it doesn't really matter what we're doing. This is our sport. We can enjoy it any way we want to enjoy it. My goal has always been to try to understand the most that I possibly can about the way the fish reacts to the flies, the way it acts to its environment, the way it reacts to the way I put the fly on the water to make it do things, so that I can maximize my catching fish, because, number one, I like to catch fish. Number two, as a fishing educator, I want to be able to tell people honestly how the fish is reacting and how we can do things so that we can overcome problems that we have in terms of the fish seeing us or hearing us or somehow otherwise interacting with us, so that we as anglers can be the best that we can possibly be. And so if all you like to do is fish dry flies, well, understanding the angler's predator can help you become a better dry fly fisher. If all you like to do is fish big bucktails and streamers, understanding the angler's predator can help you be better at that, and so on and so on.
Right, right. And this is just one part of the whole picture, you know, when you realize all that's involved.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, this is one little part, but it's such an important part because if you aren't a good predator, then the rest of it can kind of just go by the wayside. I mean, and, you know, it mean nothing. Because if you're not a good predator, then you'll never present the fly properly, then the trout will never see it, and you'll never catch fish in that regard.
You know, you mentioned the river runs through it. And, you know, of course, Jason was heavily involved in doing all the fly casting and so
right.
on. And he did the shadow cast. And there really wasn't a shadow cast. I mean, that was really Norman's sort of metaphorical description of Paul's life and the way Paul acted and behaved, bigger than life. But Jason had to make that up. And, of course, the fly is supposed to skim low over the water and then rise and go back and skim low over the water and rise. And Supposedly the shadow of the fly flitting over the surface of the waves causes the biggest fish to get all excited, and when the fly lands on the water, they come up and take it immediately. Listen, a shadow flipping over the surface of the water like that's going to do nothing but spook fish is all it's going to do.
Right.
It's just pure romantic, you know, nonsense. But it makes a great movie. And it makes a great way to think about how we like the romance of fly fishing. We like the idea of being on the river. We like, or on the lake. We like the idea of casting the fly. We like the idea of the casting part. There's some guys that like the casting more than catching fish.
Right.
And that's all okay. But when it comes down to the actual catching of fish, we've got to think and act more like predators and less like the romance that's shown in A River Runs Through It.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned, you know, the line above the water. It's a common question. I think we have maybe one tonight regarding that. But, you know, I know on a lot of the shows we've done, my guests are asked, well, you know, what color line do you use? And does that make a difference? And, you know, 9 times out of 10 or 10 times out of 10, most of my guests say, well, if the fish sees the line, it's all over. So it really doesn't make any difference what color it is. Because if they're seeing line, then they're not seeing your fly, and you've already spooked them. You know, and I thought that it's kind of like the River Runs Through It example of, you know, they shouldn't be seeing your line. Those that are gone, you know.
Yep. Well, line color can play a part. You know, when the first time I went to New Zealand in 1982, they told me, don't bring fluorescent orange lines. So I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I did very well. And I took people back later that brought fluorescent orange lines, and they actually spooked fish with them. And then I know some guys that work down on Silver Creek in Idaho there, and they said the fluorescent orange lines will sometimes spook the fish. But the thing is, it's sometimes. But my sometimes is, if that sometimes happened when I was fishing for a really big fish and I spooked them because of the line color, then I didn't want to have that kind of line. You know, I wanted to have a different color. So I tend toward the natural colors, more toward blues and grays, greens, pale yellows, tans, those kind of colors. And
well,
a
that
lot
might
of the,
that have been that they're seeing the line through their, you know, their water window there, and that it's up in the air and not really across the water?
Yeah, they're seeing it in the air.
Yeah.
Because it's much more visible.
Yeah.
And
so that's just another movement.
Yeah. In New Zealand, the water's so clear you can hardly even see the surface of it. It's amazingly clean.
Mm.
And so anything that's in the air, they're going to see it. Plus, you've got all these overhanging green trees and other kinds of stuff. So you've got a fluorescent orange line flashing against a green tree. They see it immediately.
And that's
just like
where
you would see it. Yeah.
So it's more in the air rather than on the water, kind of.
More so, yeah.
As far as
much more so.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the key characteristics of a predator? What are we... And I know you in your book you compared this to a lot of other predators that are on our planet right now.
Yeah, I listed 10 characteristics of what I call the hunter. So you think about an animal like a lion or a cheetah or a leopard or something like that, which are very distinct predators, and they're hunters. And I'll just whip through them real quick. Colored like the surroundings. So we want to make sure that we're colored like the surroundings, that we're not fluorescent orange standing out against green trees or bright white. In fact, bright white is the worst color you could possibly wear when fly fishing, except maybe if you're wading on the flats, white or blue tends to blend in a little bit better with the sky. Oftentimes I wear green because there's a lot of mangroves around, and the mangroves are green, of course, and so you can blend in that way. You have to know where to locate the prey and have the mechanisms to do it, which means you have to understand the concept of reading waters and why fish are where fish are. That's a very important part of being a predator, because if you're fishing in the wrong spot, obviously you're not going to catch anything.
Right.
Of course, the other problem is if you don't recognize the fact that a fish could be in shallow feeding lies and you wade through those, you could spook them out of there, too. So knowing the habits of the prey animal intimately goes right along with that. Trout, big brown trout, are more apt to feed at night than they are during the daytime. Rainbows like faster water around them. If there's undercut banks, browns are going to be under there. I remember one time I was up fishing on Armstrong Spring Creek, and it was one of those kind of days when there wasn't a whole lot going on, and there were smaller fish out in the middle. By smaller, I mean up to like 15 inches, rising and taking stuff. And I wanted to get some big old guys. So I put on a huge black strip leech, and I waded downstream in the middle of the stream, and I threw this thing back into every little piece of cover I could find by the bank. So it would be a little pile of crest there. I'd throw it in there, big-headed come out and take it. All these big browns were right in, some of them literally within inches of the bank. And all the small rainbows and stuff are out in the middle. So knowing the characteristics of the fish will often be a great help in understanding better how to find them and approach them and so on. Picking only prey that have a good chance of capture. You see guys on the Madison River trying to cast to the other side to fish to a rising fish. There is no way you're going to get that fish. Impossible. I mean, you can be the best caster in the world and understand everything about how to beat drag, but with that much line out, you just can't. So it's better if you pick the fish you can catch. I always tell people in big streams like that, pick 30 feet on your side and that's your river and forget the rest of it. You'll have a much better chance of catching fish if you work fish that you can catch and not just fish that you know are out there.
Yeah, the fish are always bigger on the other side, right?
Oh, of course, just like the grass is always greener, no doubt.
Yeah.
And if you catch it and it's small, you'll swear it's big anyway because you have to drag it all the way across the river.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, and, you know, a hunter watches prey organisms intently and ignores other prey. I've seen people, when they're fishing in a lake, for example, and there's a nice fish rising, and all of a sudden another one rises, they'll change and cast to that fish, and another fish rises, and they change and cast to that fish. They're just chasing fish all day and never really figure out, number one, what the fish are taking, and number two, never give the fish an opportunity to come and take the fly. So we need to really concentrate on this concept of picking a fish, working that fish, and if we don't get it and we know we put it down, you know, go to the next fish, pick a nice fish, work that fish, instead of just casting all over the place. And then predators, especially, you watch lions. They know when to be real quiet and move slowly, and then they know when to run for it. And a lot of times when I'm fishing on lakes, hunting cruisers in the shoreline, for example, I see a fish rise, and then I see it rise again, and I know it's moving away from me. Well, I don't run right up behind it, but I run out along, you know, get out maybe 50 or 60 feet up in the bank away from it, and run up and get past it and get out in front, then creeps very quietly and stealthily into place, get behind the bushes and wait on the fish to come. If you just ran up there, of course, you'd spook it immediately. So we have to know when to move quickly, when to move stealthily, and how to do both without spooking the fish in the process.
Right, right. I know, you know, I was out, this sounds funny, but walking my girlfriend's cat.
Yeah.
He thinks he's a dog, and so you can kind of, you can walk him around the neighborhood, and he follows you and stuff. And I was, he crouched down and, you know, was stalking a bird the other day, a robin that was feeding in the grass, you know. And it was very interesting to watch him, how the patience and how slow he creeped forward, you know, and
yep.
He didn't get close, but the instinct was there. You could see it.
Oh, yeah.
He's a house cat, you know, but, yeah, that stealth becomes very important.
You know, and the angler sees the fish rise instead of stopping for a second and paying attention and positioning themselves and doing the stealth kind of thing. They just race up there and cast as fast as they can, hoping they're going to catch it. We need to
right,
be
and,
a,
and there's something
to, little...
to watching them and their rhythm of feeding, too, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Yep.
And it's kind of like watching an animal that you're stalking and waiting till they're feeding and not looking up.
That's right.
The lion's not going to attach when they're looking at them. They're going to attack when they're got their head down or not paying attention.
Yep. Yeah. I always tell people that a big brown trout is every bit as spooky as a white-tailed deer. So you don't just go out in the middle of a field and walk up to a white-tailed deer.
Right.
If you're gonna approach a deer in the opening, you better be down, you better be low, you better be real super quiet. And like you say, when they put their head down, that's when you move. When they put their head up, you're just frozen. Same kind of thing if you're stalking big fish. Now, fortunately, fish have water between us and them, so there are some advantages that we have approaching a fish that we would never have approaching a deer because of the way fish can see out of the water. They have great hindrance seeing out. And maybe we can get into that later, but anyway, another thing is to have a good capture mechanism, know how to use it. A lot of times you see people hook fish, and they have no concept of what that fly rod's supposed to be doing other than sticking straight up in the air. They don't understand the concept of actually fighting the fish. They want to play with fish. Me, second that hook goes in, I have 100% advantage because the fish doesn't know I'm going to hook it. I want to keep that advantage. Most people set the hook and then give the fish the advantage and let the fish do whatever the fish wants to do. But as soon as that hook goes in, then I can get the rod to the side and pull its head around so it doesn't go into the brush, or I can, you know, do something else that I need to do to move it, or I can get the rod way up over my head so it doesn't run out and cut me off on the coral or whatever else it is I need to do. I'm fighting the fish because before I ever cast to it and ever hooked that fish, I already understood what I had to do if I did hook it in the particular place where it was. So I'd planned what I was going to do before I ever cast. And interestingly enough, when you do this consciously, just a few times, from then on, it's almost like it's an unconscious gut reaction. You know where the fish is going to go. You know what that fly rod ought to be doing. And so if the fish goes left, you put the fly rod to the right. If the fish goes right, you put the fly rod to the left. I've landed big fish without ever even using the fly rod. And there are a lot of guys now doing that on the saltwater because they've discovered that if you try to play them off the rod, it just takes way too long. So what they do is they just crank up the drag to about 6 pounds and let them fight the drag. Just point the fly rod down the line and let them fight the drag.
Right.
And it beats them a lot faster than using the fly rod. So knowing all this, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you as a predator are looking at a fish, say, rising out there or feeding in a run in a hole or something, and you've identified your prey, so to speak, so you're taking it all, when you're starting to cast to that fish, you're taking it all in, you're looking what's around, oh, there's a big log structure up on the right,
yep.
There's heavy rapids down below. So without even, it's become intuitive for you to just say, okay, if I hook up, I'm going to be pulling that fish, you know, down and to the left to avoid
right.
the structure and the rapids and so forth.
That's exactly right.
And not stick it, not high stick it, not pull it to the right, and you've got a plan. And, because that could be a 24-inch rainbow that you're trying to
that's right.
land, and it might be, you know, the fish of the summer, so to speak. So
that's right.
The more planning that goes in, the more success you have.
And once you do this, I mean, you just go and you consciously do it a few times. It's like just built in automatically because we are, after all, predators. And we just need a little bit of practice to begin thinking more like a predator and acting more like a predator. You know, another thing, there's a chapter in the book called The Pretender. And this is another characteristic of predators. And that is that young lions didn't start out catching wildebeest. Young lions started out playing with the rabbits that their mother brought home for them to play with. You know, and we see this on TV, and it's sort of gruesome to watch young, you know, this partially dead rabbit flopping around and the young lions, you know, clawing at it and so on and so on. But that's the way they learn to hunt prey. And we as anglers need to look at smaller fish as an opportunity for us to learn things about the way in which we need to cast, approach fish, the way we need to fight fish. The kind of fly that we're using, whether or not we've checked our leader to make sure there's no nicks or knots in it, and all this other kind of stuff. And a lot of times you see people seeing small fish and they just sort of blindly cast out there, and if the fish doesn't take it, well, so what? It was only a small fish anyway. The problem with that is you're not teaching yourself anything. All you're doing is teaching yourself how to do things wrong. So we need to take small fish and utilize those as a way of learning how to approach a big fish, how to make the correct cast, how to, you know, fight the fish off the reel instead of just trying to strip line. I always said the best way to keep people from stripping line and learn how to fight fish off the reel is to take them bone fishing. You know, you hook a bone fish and it runs off 100 yards of line. You're not going to strip 100 yards of backing back in again. You know,
right.
You're
right.
going to have to reel it back in.
Right.
And you catch a big rainbow on Henry's Fork, he's not going to run to the end of the fly line and stop and allow
right.
you to strip him in. He's going to take off. So we've got to learn how to use our equipment. And the best way to do that is to learn to use that on smaller fish, because then we don't have to worry so much if we make a mistake. We can compensate, you know, we can do things and learn how to do them correctly. And when the time comes and we hook a big fish, we know exactly how to do it.
So treat every small fish as a big fish, then.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, all we already do. You catch a 12-inch fish, you tell your buddies at least 16, right?
Yeah.
That's the way anglers are. They're all pretenders.
Yeah, so. That's right. That's right.
So if we pretended yeah. it was a 20-inch fish and tried to approach it that way, and what would I do if it was a big fish, and where would I cast, and where should my fly land without spooking it, and how should it drift without getting drag on it, and all those kinds of things, and begin working on that. And another thing to point out is that sometimes really, really difficult fish will teach you things that, you know, the easy fish don't teach you. And it might be a small fish in a really, really tough place, but if you figure that out, you figured out something about how to catch a bigger fish, it might be in a tough place like that.
Right.
Everything that you add to your knowledge base, of course, will help in understanding how to be a predator and how to approach fish and so on.
Yeah, yeah. And then you had, what, one last one there?
The last thing I was going to mention was this concept of persistence. You know, and that's why I was saying sometimes very difficult fish. We've got to be persistent in the way we do things, and we also have to be persistent in being the predator. Now, there's nothing wrong with just going out today and saying, you know, all I want to do is be out on the river today. If I catch a couple of fish, fine. If I don't catch any fish, I just want to be away from the workplace. I don't care. Fine. I mean, it's our sport. We can do whatever we feel like doing.
Right.
But if we're going to go out there and say, okay, I'm going to Henry's Fork today, And I'm going to hunt up a big bank feeder, and my goal is to catch a fish in Henry's Fork over 20 inches today on the size 18 PMD. Well, if that's your goal, then you better have a different set of characteristics about you than simply walking out there and flipping your line around and hoping that something takes your fly. You know, you better know how to find a big fish. You better know how to stalk a big fish. You better know how to cast correctly so you don't spook him with the casting. And when you get him on, you've only got 5X. That's about as light as you dare go there. And sometimes he won't even take it on 5X. But if you get him on 5X on a size 18 hook and he goes for the weeds, now what do? You know, all these things are built in. So
right.
We as anglers, acting as predators acting as anglers, actually, I have to understand all this and then build all that into the way we do things. And like I say, using the small fish to practice for the big ones, thinking consistently and constantly and persistently about how we do things, all that helps. And
yeah,
back to this big fish in Henry's Fork, I've seen guys make 15 or 20 casts and quit and leave. Well,
yeah.
If the fish is still rising, you know, the opportunity is there until he quits rising.
I guess one thing that we don't have working for us in this day and age is the need for survival. You know, the other predators we've talked about, if they don't get it right, they die.
That's right.
For us, it's a luxury because if we don't get it right, we can go home and have a beer. But drown our sorrows. But, yeah. Or go to the market. But
that's right.
But I remember doing an interview with Daniel Gallardo on Tenkara, and he was talking about where the Tenkara fly rods and type of fishing originated in Japan,
right.
And they were commercial fishermen with just a bamboo pole and a, you know, no reel and just a line. Well, they had to be darn good because they made their living off of that, and they had the simplest of equipment. And that kind of very interesting to me about how that got going. And they didn't need all the gear, and yet they were probably more successful than most of us because they probably understood everything that you just talked about, and they did it every day. So that was kind of interesting.
And they were masters at manipulating the fly on the water so that it looked alive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they only used 3 or 4 patterns, and they tied the soft tackles so that they were pointing to the front rather than pointing to the back. And then when they would move the rod, the hackle would pulse very strongly, and they were fishing all small mountain streams.
Right.
So this idea of hiding back in the brush, you know, it's just poking your rod out and dipping it into these spots. And I mean, they're very much the hunters.
Right, right.
Yep, very much so.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Gary.
Right.
I'll be right back, and then we'll continue talking about the angler as a predator. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Visit their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about the angler as predator. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. You receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many as possible on the show tonight. Well, Gary, I always ask my guests what's been going on in their fly fishing world, and I know what you've been doing. At least part of it is doing the writing. And geez, you've got quite a few books to go.
Number 5 is already finished. We're just doing the layup on.
Oh, really?
Getting the photos and everything pulled together, and I'm already 3 chapters or 4 chapters into the first casting book. So.
Okay, so
things are moving along. Yeah.
You want to give people a preview of your next book?
The next book is called Fly Gear, and it's on obviously rods, reels, lines, and not only just using them but selecting them. I mean, so much has happened in lines within the last 20 years that it's just amazing, absolutely stunning what's happened. And, of course, rods have only gotten better, and reels, of course, are getting better. And, of course, there are other things to talk about, but the idea is, where did all this stuff come from? Why do we use it the way we do now? And how can we select exactly what it is that we need to fit the situations that we fish under?
Right, right.
And, you know, it seems like a small amount to write about, 208 pages, but I guarantee you there's Yeah, I could have done a book three times as long.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's just so much.
All you have to do is go to one of the fly fishing shows and start going from vendor to vendor and get...
That's right.
And you get confused rather quickly. So I'm sure this would be a great, great tool for all of us to have to kind of sort all that out and make heads or tails of it. And I'm assuming, you know, you've talked about where and what kind of fishing and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
All those sorts
of things.
Yeah.
And specifically about line designs and why lines work the way they do. You know, the most unique piece of equipment that fly anglers have is the line. Mm-hmm. That's what makes fly fishing.
Right.
You can take a fly rod and put a spinning reel on it and fish just fine. And you can even take a bait casting rod and put a fly line on it and cast it just fine. It's the line that's the real thing that's different in fly fishing. So understanding the concept of the way the mass profile is laid out along the line and how the tapers are built and what they do and a whole bunch of other things are very important to us as fly fishers when it comes to actually picking a line to do the job. Fortunately, we have some incredible lines now, and the people that are designing them are fly fishers.
Right.
You know, Bruce Richards at Scientific Anglers for years and years was their line designer, and I've known Bruce, you know, I don't know how many years, but Bruce was a superb fly fisher, so he understood what lines had to do. Same thing at Rio. I mean, you had Jim Vincent, who was a maniac fly fisherman and maniac baitcaster, and now you've got people like Simon Gosworth and others, and these guys are all fly fishers, so they've been... Like I say, in the last 20 years, lines have just gone crazy.
Right.
Because they
right.
know what a fly fisherman needs, and they said, well, this line might do it, but I got a better idea for another line that might do that, or this or that. So all of a sudden, lines have become sort of the darling of the manufacturing industry out there. For a while, it was reels, and, you know. So anyway, there's a lot to look at, and it's very exciting and very interesting stuff.
Right. And then the next three books all have to do with casting, correct?
That's right.
Good.
They're called the Perfect Cast 1, the Perfect Cast 2, and the Perfect Cast 3. And I'm going to ask you, Roger, what's the definition of a perfect cast?
The one that's most effective in the situation you're in.
That's right, the one that catches the fish. Everybody tells me exactly the same thing. So this is not a book on how to make a cast that looks perfect to somebody else. These are books on the cast that does the thing in the situation that you need it in.
Perfect, perfect, yeah,
yep.
Yeah. Yep, makes sense. Well, I did get a question here on the Internet that revolves around casting and around Jason's book. Bill McCartney wrote in and he says, I have Jason's first book about fly casting and I think it is excellent. Does he have a second volume coming out? And if so, what is the focus of the book?
Jason is actually working on a new book called Single Hand Casting. And if he goes to Jason's website, which is just jasonborger.com, he can see information there on it.
Great. Hey, there you go, Phil.
Yep.
So in combination with Jason's book, his upcoming book, and Gary's upcoming three books, you'd be all set for casting.
That's right.
I suppose, yeah. Yeah, what more could you want? Yeah. Well, let's dive back into some of the questions that come in here. Oh, one other thing I wanted you to talk about out of your book that I thought was very interesting. Was the difference between small fish and big fish. And, you know, like you said, we always, as humans, give the fish human attributes, and we always say that, you know, the bigger the fish, the smarter and more wiser the fish is. So
great.
Do you want to explain to the folks out there your take on that and
let's start
how that
smart.
Really works?
Sure. The smarts is that a brown trout has an IQ of 6. Now, don't ask me how they measured that. Somebody with an IQ of 8 measured it, probably. I don't know, okay? But it's extremely low. And the idea is that a big fish is smarter. Well, they're not smarter. An IQ of 6 is an IQ of 6. So true trout can learn some things, but they also forget it very quickly. You can entrain trout on color and on shape. In other words, if you put in a pellet that's a red pellet, they'll learn to eat those, and you put green ones in, they won't eat them. If you put in pellets that are shaped like stars, and then you put in pellets that are shaped like a cross, they won't eat them. I mean, it's weird, but they learn that. But you stop feeding that kind of stuff for a couple of weeks, and they forget it. So they can become entrained more than learn. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So now we've got a fish that's got an IQ of 6. And how does one get to be big and another one never gets big? Well, number one, you got to remember that we're talking about survival of the fittest. So fit means what? Fit means better able to withstand drought and flood, better immune system perhaps, more able to withstand disease and sickness, more quick to run at danger. And this is the biggest thing that anglers miss out on. The biggest fish are the biggest scaredy cats in the pool. So when you come wading up to the pool, flicking that line back and forth and false casting it around, looking for a place to lay the fly down, if it flicks back and forth a couple times over a big fish, they don't come to the surface and go, oh, I'm a big fish and you scared me, and run back into the bank. They're just gone. You never see them. You never have an opportunity to fish to them. So that's why I say this idea of the predator. You know, the lion doesn't run out into the middle of the wildebeest and go, I'm going to come out here and eat one of you pretty soon. Better get yourselves ready, and then run back again. No, the lion hides and waits, gets his opportunity, then goes for it.
Right.
So we as anglers often miss it because we have, like I said, we have this romantic notion about fly fishing, that it's out there and we're casting the line and it's beautiful, you know, and it's been called a poetry with nature and it's been called all these other different things. But when it comes to just catching fish straight out, the more we act like the predator, the better we are. Now, big fish behave differently than small fish because big fish are big. And by that I mean they weigh more. So it takes more food to fill them up. They have to eat more calories per day. They can't leap out of the water and grab little flies way up there. They've got to be very slow and deliberate in the way they take food, and they can't waste a lot of energy. So big fish often present a much smaller rise pattern, maybe, than a small fish. You've got to really pay attention to what's going on and watch. And you have to watch, you know, how much water displacement there is, and if it's poking its nose out, how big is the nose, and lots of other things. And I've seen guys on Henry's Fork walk right past big fish that are feeding within 2 or 3 feet of the bank and never see them, simply because, number one, they didn't know the fish were feeding close to the bank. They thought all the big fish are going to be in the middle, which is another mistake that a lot of fishermen make. And the second thing was they weren't paying attention to what was going on around them. When I fish Henry's Fork, I wade in the middle and look to the bank, because that's where the big fish are. So understanding these kinds of things and being able to apply them to your specific angling situations. First time I went to New Zealand, the guy that had invited me down there, he was a friend of a friend, and he said, if you ever come down, you know, I'll take you fishing. So I said, all right. So I went down, and he took me fishing. The first thing he did was take me to a small stream to see if I knew what I was doing. And when I stopped him before he could see the fish, and I saw it first and then cast and caught it, then he said, okay. And then he took me fishing. But his idea of somebody from the United States was a guy that gets in the middle of a river and wades up casting and casting and casting, and not somebody that knew how to stalk and hunt fish.
Right, right. Yeah.
So big fish behave differently because they are bigger. It takes more food to fill them up. They're usually looking for bigger food items than smaller fish. Now, let's say there's a big hatch going on, and the big fish are locked in on the insects that are hatching. All right, then they're going to have to eat a lot more times than the small fish. So there's a lot of opportunities to catch these big fish if you don't spook them in the process. Remember, they're the biggest scaredy cats in the pool. The fly lands on them, they're gone. The line whips over top of them, they're gone. The fly drags sometimes, they're gone. It's just, you've just got to be very, very careful and very precise in your fishing. That's what you need to really focus on, learning from the small fish how better to approach, how, you know, all the kinds of things that you have to learn to catch the bigger fish.
How do you think about, you know, when you go to a river and, you know, you'll hear guides or fly fishermen talk about that the fish have, you know, they know about that kind of fly. They're not taking that anymore because it's been so used, you know, let's just say it's a gold-ribbed hares here. Mm-hmm. And they've seen so many gold-ribbed hares here in here because of the pressure that they just won't take them anymore. So how does that play a role in their memory or their conditioning?
That's like
true?
In training. Hmm? Yeah, that's like in training or conditioning, and that can happen. I've seen trout on Armstrong Spring Creek and Depew Spring Creek that would not take a natural on the surface. I've seen others that would take the natural and act like they were hooked, actually shaking their head and racing around and then going like, oh, I'm not hooked, and then go someplace else to feed. They never fed twice in the same spot. That's in training. That is just, but yet they're taking dry flies off the top. I mean, they're hungry. They got to eat. And sometimes you'll get to a river and, you know, there's a hot fly on that river. Well, that hot fly might be because it more closely simulates something that's in the river that people don't understand about.
Right.
You know, there might be a huge number of crest bugs and scuds in the river, and people don't know that, and so they're fishing these flies that could match those. And, well, the golden hares here doesn't work right now. It's this fly that works because they've eaten the golden hares here too much. Well, that might not be the truth. We really don't know everything there is to know, and understand everything there is to understand. These are, after all, biological organisms.
Right,
and as
right.
they say, the fish are going to pretty well much do what the fish want to do. You know?
It's kind of like if they got conditioned on green drakes this week and then they had to switch over to blue-winged olives the next week, then because of the conditioning, even though they were very conditioned for the green drakes, they're not going to take them this week.
That's
and,
right.
And totally ignore them, even though last week they were perfectly
yep.
fine.
Yep.
Just because they've been conditioned to a new hatch.
And, you know, interestingly, speaking about the green drakes, Mike Lawson was the first one, I think, to observe this and told me about it. But he said that on Henry's Fork, when the green drakes would first start hatching, the big fish would actually spook from them because they didn't realize it was food. But after a few days, you know, suddenly they were eating them like crazy. But the first few days, some of the bigger fish would actually spook from the adults coming down.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. Yep.
Yeah, I could see that, yeah. So let's talk about, I wrote down here, dressing for success.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of questions about clothing, and Martin Coleman wrote in, and he says, how does clothing types and colors affect your visibility to fish? And then we've got a number of other questions regarding that, but why don't we start with that, and you can talk in general, and then we can get into more specifics about it.
Okay. Well, in general, very quickly, I can tell you that white is the worst color, period. Because white reflects the most light. So I don't care whether you're fishing on the flats or whether you're fishing, you know, in a trout stream or whether you're fishing in Alaska. White is the worst color, period. Now, if you're fishing in a region, let's say back east, where the trees are dark green, wear a green fishing vest. You can wear a blue shirt or a brown shirt or a tan shirt because that would all blend in with tree bark and all kinds of rocks and other kinds of things. But what you want to do is you want to break up your profile as much as you can. I know guys that wear camo when they fish. That's fine. I don't care. But I don't really think you need to go that extreme. Charlie Brooks, who is a retired Air Force major that lived in West Yellowstone and for a number of years, used to wear camouflage. He put a nylon stocking over his face. He took all the finish off his fly rod. He used black fly lines. I mean, you can go to the greatest extreme if you want to, but I'm talking about the average guy going out there and just having a good time fishing, and the idea is that you're going to catch as many fish as you want, and you're not going to spook too many fish. Don't wear a white hat. You know, take off bright, shiny things off your vest. Do those kinds of things. There's a really great DVD that a friend of mine, Ozzy Ozovich, came out with, in which he shows from underwater, shooting from underwater, shows his brother walking out with a light-colored hat on. And then his brother takes that hat off and puts another hat on, and he just about disappears just because he changes his hat. It's amazing how much color plays a role in our visibility to the fish. And like I say, white's the worst. Jason once did a TV pilot with a friend, Doug Frymouth, and they shot underwater shots from underwater, like the fish looking up, of an angler wearing white shirt against a green, you know, green background, and then wearing green. The white was amazing how you could, I mean, it's almost like they were glowing. And when they put the green on, they basically just disappeared. So you want to wear clothing that helps you to blend in with the background, and you can hide behind things and hide in front of things. If you have clothing that's very similar in color to vegetation, you can stand in front of the vegetation as well as standing in behind the vegetation. And surprisingly, in Ozzy's video, he also showed that one of the most important things is the leader. Because the flash coming off the leader is the last thing that's going to be close to the fish's window. So if you
that
throw the leader
glint.
High,
yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how much, yeah, how much sparkle that throws off. It's just amazing.
How do you get rid of that? How do you?
Well,
that?
I use Maxima Chameleon, which is a dark brown line for my butt sections and tapered sections on my leaders, and that helps to cut that down. Because it's not, you know, it's not clear, so it doesn't shine as much as a clear leader would shine. The other way, of course, you get rid of that is that you don't cast with the line high in the air. You cast with the line a little bit more sidearm, and you, or maybe even, you know, completely sidearm, depending on what you're capable of doing in the situation that you're fishing in. But try to keep the line a little bit lower over the water. My fishing cast, even though I can cast perfectly well with the rod straight up and down, my actual fishing cast is with the rod out at about a 60-degree angle. Simply because I can throw the line lower over the surface that way than I can casting straight. And keeping the line low keeps it, you know, less visible to the fish. And if it's less visible to the fish, less chance of spooking them.
Now, We had another couple questions about dressing. Phil and Marie Utah asked about bright-colored fishing shirts. I don't know what he means by bright, if he means fluorescent orange or bright white, which would be, of course, not good. But there's, you know, in the fashion industry now, there's some, you know, lime green and things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that plays a role?
Those are good for apres fishing.
Apres fishing.
When you're back by the fireplace telling everybody how many big fish you caught today.
Yeah.
I'll give you another really good example. A lot of times you see guys on magazine covers with a red shirt on. Well, there's a saying in photography, if you can't make it good, make it red. So usually photographers like to have something of color, because who wants a magazine cover of a guy dressed up in camouflage with a sock pulled over his head holding a trout up? I mean, that wouldn't sell a single magazine. So,
yeah.
In one of Mike Lawson's programs, he shows himself with this bright red shirt on holding up a nice big fish. Then he says, here's what I was wearing when I caught it, and he shows you what he was wearing. Well,
right.
He takes a bright red shirt with him, and when he's catching a fish in a dull green shirt, then he puts the red shirt on, so you want a photograph. So
yeah.
You've got the kind of photograph that you could sell for a magazine cover or something.
Right.
So
right.
Bright colors tend to reflect an awful lot of light.
Yeah.
And because they reflect a lot of light, much greater chance for the fish to see you, especially against background. And Nancy and I took a trip to Africa one time. And we actually had an opportunity to go horseback riding. And the guy said, hey, would you like to go horseback riding? We said, horseback riding in Africa, that'd be really cool. So we're on the horses and we're riding, you know. And we're gone for about 20 minutes, and the guy that's leading us says, by the way, if anything happens, just give your horses headed. We knows what to do. And we said, what do you mean if anything happens? He said, we lost a horse here last week. And we said, what do you mean lost a horse? Well, a lion got it. We were riding, and a lion got the horse and killed him. We said, what about the guy that was riding? Oh, he got away. I'm looking around, and the grass is exactly lion color. So, there are no fluorescent orange lions.
Right, exactly.
Because they want to be blended in. They're predators, and they want to be a part of the environment, not standing out from the environment. That's the way we need to think. If we're out there seriously fishing and really, really trying to be the best that we can be, we need to be environmentally colored, not fluorescent orange.
Right. And like you said, it doesn't have to be camo, but even,
no.
You know, maybe a green shirt with a brown vest, and
sure.
You're going to blend in with the forest.
Yeah, then you're basically camoed anyway. Then when you do that,
yeah.
You're just bigger
yeah.
chunks, like, you know, chunks of trees or whatever. Yeah.
But talk for a minute about what they can actually see through that window. I know you've got a picture in your book. I don't know if you can explain that.
Sure.
You know, verbally.
When a fish is looking at the surface, what it sees doesn't depend upon its eye. It depends upon a principle called refraction, the bending of light, as it passes from air into water or backward from water into air. What happens is when light passes from the air into the water, it bends sharply. So when a fish is looking at the surface, it sees a circular opening that has a 97-degree apical angle. In other words, the angle of the cone that the fish is looking at its eye, is 97 degrees. All the light from above, which is 180 degrees from horizon to horizon, is compressed into that 97. That means that objects in the window are greatly compressed, especially at the edges of the window where the compression is greatest. Now, this has great benefit for the fly fisher, because things that are tremendously compressed at the edge of the window basically just turn into the background. Unless, of course, they're white. Now, I have a photograph in the book that shows from New Zealand, and there's a mountain there. And from underwater, you can't even see the mountain, because it gets compressed and just becomes a green rim around the edge of the window. And it's very undiscernible to you as an angler, and it's undiscernible to the fish. I mean, they don't know that's a mountain. It's just a green ring around the edge of the window. But you put a white fly fisherman over there casting line at them, they're going to see that. But green over there, they won't see it. So we as anglers need to stay basically under the 10-degree line where the compression is the greatest and stay back about 30 feet. If we get closer, get down on the old hands and knees and crawl so you can stay under that 10-degree line so that you can stay basically in the compressed zone just as a part of the environment around you. And, of course, you know, you crawl up within 15 feet and then stick your fly rod up in the air and start pulse casting like a maniac. No, you need to be able to, you know, cast sidearm and keep the line low over the surface so that you're keeping it down very low so that there's less chance that the fish can see it. if we can take advantage of what the fish can't see, which is this stuff at the edge of its window, basically anything under that 10-degree angle above the surface of the water. I mean, it's all compressed. So if we can stay under there, we can get very close to fish. I've snuck up on them close enough to be able to actually poke them with the fly rod. And they're like, what the heck is that? And they don't even move. But stand up and watch what they do. You know?
Right.
They're going like a shot. Yeah.
And then with matching your clothing to the background, then you're going to be even, you know, less.
That's disturbing. Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, there was somebody wrote in that there wasn't a name attached to this one, but he's heard that if you're slow in your movements and quiet in the water, that what you wear doesn't matter as much. That I don't completely agree with that thinking, but not willing to spend my time in a stream testing theory.
Yeah.
Smart. have you heard of such thought and any truth to it? You still have, even if you're camoed in whatever way, shape, and you're in this, you know, the compressed area, we still have to deal with movement, though.
That's right. That's the key right there. Because, yes, if you're very quiet and sneak very, very carefully, even if you're wearing bright clothing and you go very slowly, yes, you can get up close to fish. But the second you move that rod, that arm moves, they're gone because they see it. What we're trying to do is minimize our visibility, not just necessarily the fact that we're an angler. We're trying to minimize visibility. I mean, you watch a heron. They're slow, slow, slow. And then when the time comes to strike, boom, they strike. Well, that's what we have to be, is very, very slow. We have to stalk, hunt, watch. You know, I mean, you get to a river, I'll give you an example, here in the Lake States, you know, we have big runs of salmon and big brown trout and steelhead coming up out of the Great Lakes into our tributary streams. Well, you get to a tributary stream, and there's 50,000 salmon in there. I mean, all you have to do is glance, and you can see salmon everywhere. So guys will just run in there and start casting like maniacs. Well, the salmon are in there because they're in there to spawn, and they're not going to leave. But they're not going to take your fly either because they know that you're, you know, you're not part of the environment. So, again, the same kind of thing applies. If you can stalk and sneak and hunt, you can catch a lot more of those salmon than you can if you just run down there and start casting to them. Same thing applies no matter what kind of fish it is.
Right, right. Rodney in Portland, Oregon, wrote in and you know, kind of switching over to your approach and your strategy on approaching the fish. He says, what is some of the thought processes you go through before you step into the water? Fish close to the bank, step in only if you have to, move slowly, crouch down. Are there others? And then he talks about, I always think of the heron and how they move. So do you want to talk about, you know, your,
sure.
your thought process?
I think
there?
one of the earliest best pieces of advice that I read, you know, I just learned to fly fish on my own. I learned basically by reading. But it was Joe Brooks, and he said, never weight it before you fish it. By that he means don't just go into the river, and everybody likes to get in at least above their knees because then they feel like they're fishing. You know how many fish there are between that depth and shore? Sometimes an awful lot of them. And so it's better if you would fish the water before you start wading into it. Now, Charlie Brooks, who was this guy that lived up there in West Yellowstone, would yell at people when they got in up to their knees, get out of my hole, you're standing in where the fish are. And they would say, what do you mean? He'd tell them, if you're in water, knee-deep or deeper, you're where the fish live. You're in the prime lies. Get out of there. Stand back and fish into that water. And he would prove it, of course, time and time again by catching big fish where they'd been waiting. So the idea is that we always think that the big fish live in the deepest water. And, of course, in the middle, and, of course, behind a great big rock in the middle of the rapids. That's where the big fish live. Nothing could be further from the truth. Big fish are going to live where they have the least amount of energy expenditure and the most grub around. Now, you go to fish the Madison River, and you fish it in the evening, right before dark. Most of the time, I don't wear waders. I just walk along the bank and fish the big fish right by the bank, and you catch 18 to 24-inch fish all the time doing that. But most guys think you got to go in the middle, you know, and cast way out there and all that kind of stuff. No, the big fish are going to go where the food is. And in the evening, the best food is close to the banks because that's where all the caddises are dancing around, you know, and the midges are there and all kinds of food as in the river. So as anglers, we have to be very appreciative of the fact that the, number one, the river is the fish's house. Number two, if you're in the house, the fish knows you're there. And if it's a big fish, it always knows you're there. So if we take that attitude, we have a much better chance of catching fish. When I get to a river, the first thing I do is not just wade in and start fishing. I usually spend a couple seconds while looking around. If there's a hatch going on, we know where the fish are, so that makes our dealing a lot easier. If we don't know, then it's time to start reading water and looking for specific kinds of places where fish might be holding what we call prime lies, that is a place where they get food and protection at the same time, and then decide whether I want to go nymph fishing or streamer fish or a great big fish or maybe just flick dry flies and have a fun day just flicking dry flies. So that's sort of the process that I go through when I first get to a place where I'm fishing.
We had Mark Johnston in Lansing, Michigan, wrote in and he says, I'm relatively new to fly fishing and constantly wonder about how far away I have to be from the fish to remain stealthy. Is wading downstream a death blow because the fish feels me coming? You want to talk a little bit about what they can and can't feel and from what direction, if that makes a difference, like he's talking about?
Sure. In quiet pools, the rings that you send out when you wade are a surefire sign to the fish that there's a predator close by. So you got to be as quiet and as stealthy as you can be. Doesn't matter if they're wading up or down. When you're in riffles and rapids, doesn't matter. You can jump in a river and splash around and go for a swim, and you're not going to bother the fish at all because they can't hear you. Just too much background noise. Any waves that you generate and send out are going to be washed away by the water immediately. That's why most anglers catch more fish in riffles than they do in pools, simply because the fish can't see you nor hear you nearly as well in the riffle as they can in the pool. And as a consequence, you can get really, really close to them. I was telling you earlier about Ozzy Ozovich and been filming these things. He walked into a riffle one time and just shoved his camera down underneath there. And there was an 18-inch brown trout laying right in front of him. Now, he has his camera on an 8-foot stick, so 8 feet away, there's an 18-inch brown trout. So he calls to his brother, hey, Joe, come down, there's a big brown right here in front of me. So his brother comes down, casts out, and catches it. And he gets the shot of the fish taking the fly and everything. In riffle water, they can't see you well because the surface is all broken.
Yeah.
And they can't hear you because any of those waves that you generate get washed away.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In riffle water, anglers usually find they're much more successful than they are in pools simply for that reason. It doesn't matter whether you wade downstream or upstream. Most of the time when I'm fishing dries, I'm actually fishing down, not up, because I get a much better grift fishing downstream than I do fishing upstream.
I think a lot of people, and I think you've explained this, but a lot of people think that if you're upstream, then, well, the fish is looking forward and can see you better than if you're downstream from the fish. But it all has to do with that window, regardless
exactly
of where
right.
you are.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And, you look at the older books and they talk about there being a blind spot behind the fish, and there is a small blind spot. But again, let me go to Ozzy. He has the camera down behind a fish, and the fish is rolling its left eye back, watching the camera, and rolling its right eye forward, watching for food. They can move their eyeballs around.
Independently, huh? Yeah.
And the blind spot only applies to the underwater part anyway, not to what they see above the water. Above what they see above the water, there is no blind spot. What there is that compressed zone around the edge of the window, that's the under 10 degrees above the horizon, above the water. Anything that's under that 10-degree line is all compressed dramatically. And that's where we want to try to stay. Now, talk about how far away you stay from the fish. Probably let's go back to the first book that was really, our first chapter in a book that was really focused just on fly fishing. And that was Isaac Walton's book, The Complete Angler, and a chapter written there by Charles Cotton. Charles wrote the chapter to the 1676 edition of Walton's Complete Angler. And in there he talks about, for the trout you fish fine and far off, and then for him that was about 30 feet away. And the reason is, if you're 30 feet away, you're basically under the 10-degree line.
Right, right.
So if you stay 30 to 40 feet back, you're in that compressed zone. The fish really doesn't see you that well, unless you've got a white shirt on, of course. But, they don't see you that well, and you can cast and you can catch them. You get closer and you spook them. Unless you're down on your hands and knees.
Right. So if you're down on your hands and knees and you're side casting, then you can get 15 feet away.
You can get 15 feet away. That's right.
Right. Yeah. Yep. I just wanted to throw this in here because it's so right on, and we didn't talk about this, but Jim from Jefferson City, Missouri wrote in here on the internet, and he says, in the Ozarks, we fish for trout year round. The color white actually makes sense to wear when snow is on the ground.
That's good.
Good point.
I like it, Jim. That's good. That's right.
And that's true here in Colorado.
Does he wear a carrot on his nose too?
No, that would be you know, fluorescent orange. So we don't.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. No, but yeah, he's got a point. Hey, you know, use your head, right? Use your head.
That's right.
Think about your environment.
That's
or like
right.
you said, on the flats, or if it's a blue sky or whatever, just do the right thing.
Yep.
Yeah, and from a stealth standpoint, I guess Anthony in Half Moon Bay wrote in, and he wants to know if you use mono or fluorocarbon. Is that part of the stealth approach?
No, that's not really a part of the stealth. It is a slight part of stealth, because it's harder for fish to see fluorocarbon under the water than it is for them to see nylon under the water. And the guys that have really found fluorocarbon really significant in their fishing are, number one, the tarpon guys, because they use it for shock tippets. You can use 60-pound fluorocarbon where you'd only use 40-pound nylon. And the other guys that have found it really, really effective are the guys that fish for steelhead, because you can use 12-pound where the other guys are using 8. And the fish can't see the 12-pound fluorocarbon any better than they'd see 8-pound nylon. So in that sense, yes, there is a little bit of stealth involved in that, a little bit of less visibility of the leader, and allowing you to use heavier leaders. And I know a lot of guys that fish fluorocarbon, and I haven't really found any difference in fishing dry flies or just standard nymphs or any of that kind of stuff. But those two places, people really have found large differences.
Another question came in. Rodney in Portland, Oregon wrote in, and he says, Gary, thanks for your contributions to angling and my education of fly fishing. As you approach a body of water, how does the brokenness or nervousness of the water's surface affect how close you will get to the lie? Will it dictate whether you fish upstream or downstream? So this goes back to that window, too. Not so much maybe a riffle, but water with some kind of activity on it.
Yeah, it could be wind activity. When there's choppy water and so on, it's much easier to get closer to the fish. If the water gets fine chop on top, real fine, a lot of times fish will just stop feeding on the surface because they can't see out.
Mm.
And so if there's fine chop on, it breaks up the window so much and makes things so difficult to see out that they just stop feeding on the surface. So when I get to a place, if it's riffle, like I said before, you know, I'm not really worried about the fish seeing or hearing me. Of course, I'm going to fish close water first, and then I'm going to wade out a little bit. Usually I don't like to wade I wear waders that are only waist high. I don't wear chest waders. And the reason I don't is that, number one, I don't want to be out there in deep water and get myself in trouble. But number two, if I can't reach with the casting and standing up to my knees, I don't want to fish it. I mean, I can cast a whole fly anyway, but I don't want to do that. You know, I want to fish in a place where I know I can control the fish, I know I can control the line. And so I don't try to wade too deep. I'd rather explore the water with a fly line than explore it by wading around and spooking everything. If it's a quiet pool, obviously you want to pay real close attention, watch what's going on, watch the edges, because a lot of times there'll be big fish in close, even in pools. And pay attention to what
right.
the river's telling you and what the conditions are telling you, understanding what you know about the way fish see and hear, and you can be a very decent predator with no problems at all.
Yeah, I've mentioned this on other shows that I have a private lake here by my house that I fish quite often, inevitably every evening as you get towards dusk, if you just stop and watch, you'll see very large fish within 3 feet of the bank.
Yeah.
And they're only in a foot of water. And they only do that as the light wanes and they feel more protected. But that's a big mistake to make on that lake, is to just walk up to the edge and start casting in the middle. You should just walk around the edge and work the edge all the way around the lake, and then you'll do a lot better.
I've actually seen that happen more in lakes than I have in streams.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are more people. I mean, the best place to fish in a lake is always on the other side. So they get in the boat and go to the other side, right?
Right.
And then the best place is always out in the middle, because big fish would never go near shore.
No, it's
many, many
out there.
Times,
yeah.
Many times in trout lakes, they're right against the bank. I mean, why? Because there's a lot of food there.
Yeah, yeah.
They never lay out in the middle and starve to death. I mean, they go where the food is. So
exactly. The other thing, and I don't know, maybe if this is the reason or not, but because of what you just said about wind surface agitation, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same lake, I can go down there and there'll be a you know, a wind blowing and, you know, there's ripples on the surface and I'm not doing any good with it. I'm not seeing any activity, and not doing any good on the surface with any dries. And then inevitably, you know, as the sun goes down, the wind stops and it goes flat. And it's almost like a switch. As soon as it goes flat,
yep,
the feeding begins. And I'm wondering if it's what you just talked about and the fact that they can't see well, so they're not feeding on the surface, and as soon as it goes flat, they can see and they start feeding.
There's two factors. One is that does go flat and it's easier. And the second thing is that there's a tremendous amount of insect activity right at dawn and right at dusk. So midges almost always will be hatching at dusk and in the morning, first thing. And so there will be activity, more increased activity than there will be during the daytime.
Combination of the two.
Yeah. So it's a combination of the two. Yep.
Yeah. Walt Cole asked, he's out in Redding, California. He's talking about stillwater fishing, but this probably would apply mm-hmm. either way. He says, since smell is one way to detect something unnatural to the fish, do you feel it's a good idea to take a nymph or a streamer and rub it in mud or aquatic plants before using it? I know this question's come up before. I think tires think
sometimes. Sometimes, I mean, I know guys that will say, well, they take my fly a lot more when I take my human scent off because I dip it in sardine oil or something. Yeah, right. Oh, I spray WD-40 on it. You know. Well, WD-40 used to be made out of fish oil. It's not anymore, but it used to be. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, and they say, well, I rub mud on it or something. Well, I don't really think that the scent of human scent on a fly is that critical. I just don't think it is, because the first thing that attracts fish will be either the sound of the fly moving through the water or its visual footprint. So either it's acoustic footprint or visual footprint. And they'll strike out of that. You know, if they have a chance to get the fly in their mouth and chew on it for a while, taste might be important, the smell might be important. But I would say 99.9% of the times, no. I know some guys on the West Coast that fish for salmon, and they always put on latex gloves when they tie their flies. Of course, you know, what kind of scent was put on there and all the chemical processing of dyeing them and all that kind of stuff, you know. So,
right.
It's one of those kind of questions that I don't think we'll ever answer satisfactorily. We know that salmon migrate by the smell of the water. We know that for sure. We also know that if you take a sea lion skin and dip it in a river where there's a bunch of salmon, they'll flush and get out of there. I mean, they'll just take right off because they know that scent. So they do have that capability. We also know if you dip your flies and mash up some eggs and put your fly in air, it'll work a lot better. They can smell it. So scent does have some effect. But it may be that scent has having more of a positive effect than scent is having a negative effect, meaning that it doesn't go smell your fly and go, oh, humans, I don't want to eat that fly.
Right.
Because I've caught tons of salmon on eggs and other kinds of flies, and, you know, you don't know. It's one of those kind of things.
Yeah, you think about power bait, how well power bait works,
mm.
you know, and that smells really nasty. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So, but, when you think about that, we're giving them, I guess it would be a smell of an unknown that would force them to go away from it, because they certainly don't know what humans smell like.
There is some evidence that things like hydrocarbons on your fly, but hydrocarbons, you know, are always spewing out some stuff too, like, you know, the scum patch that oil leaves behind.
Right.
Hydrocarbons tend to have a negative effect on there because it's such a powerful scent. Mm-hmm. But whether human scent really is or not is just, period, just not known.
And then it's the opportunity, right? If a nymph is coming down the stream, they've got like a split second to take it or not take it.
They're never
going to smell it.
They're
not smelling it first,
no,
right?
They're not smelling it first.
Yeah. So, what do they, the fish actually hear? And We talk about water waves, you know, that mm-hmm. we create when we wade in. But are they actually hearing us, or is that all the lateral line business?
Well, fish hear. They have an inner ear mechanism. They don't have ears like we do because they don't need one. They're basically in water, and they're mostly made of water. So the sounds that we would generate, like our talking sounds and compressive sounds, go right through the fish. So they don't need an outer ear. They can hear that with their inner ear. But the sounds that really are the ones that we have to watch out for, not so much the sounds of a clinking waiting staff or a waiting shoe clunking on the bottom, because there's so much sound underwater anyway. And, you know, occasional sound like that's not going to spook the fish. The sound we really have to worry about is the displacement sound. When you wade, you displace water, and it makes the ripples that go out. That kind of sound is the kind of sound that can spook fish. And you watch a heron wade. It just lifts its foot very quietly and inserts it very quietly. It hardly makes the slightest ripple at all. You know, and they can wade up very quietly on fish, very slowly, very quietly. I was fishing one time in England with Brian Clark, and he said, "I've learned how to lift my foot like a heron and slide the bank in." And he was wading. I tried it and fell down, got soaked three times. I said, "Forget it. I'm just going to go slow and easy." You know, I'll be the hippopotamus that wades slowly, not the heron. So,
yeah.
Anyway, they definitely can hear that. And the impact of the fly line on the surface, you know, sends out those waves too, and that can spook fish.
Yeah, yeah.
So we want to try
now, is
to
that actually
minimize.
A sound, or is that
yes? Well,
water
it is a sound in the sense that the fish have an acoustic, like a sonar kind of device that detects that, and they have cells in their lateral line that detect that as a kind of sound. Yeah, mm-hmm. A compressive wave. It's actually an interesting mechanism because it can detect the displacement in water, the water movement of, let's see, 1 inch in 25 seconds. So if the water's moving at that speed, 1 inch in 25 seconds, it can detect that speed with its lateral line. That's how come they can position themselves so perfectly in a river. And you see a fish laying down there, it's not even moving. And how does it lay in that current and not move? Well, it can find the perfect spot to lay in because it can detect those currents. So you figure if they can detect something that's moving at a speed of only, 1 inch in 25 seconds, and you're sending out these big waves, certainly they can feel that and certainly they hear it. And we all know that when we wade and the fish, waves go across the fish, it spooks them and they flush out. We've all seen that many, many times.
Sure.
So it's empirical evidence of what science has actually shown to be true.
And I know you're going to deal with this in your future books, as we talked about. Martin Coleman asks, what are some good casting techniques for fly fishers wanting to become effective predators?
Well, I think the number one thing is to keep the line a bit lower. I often use what we call an elliptical stroke when I'm casting. That is, you go back a little bit sidearm and then shift the rod around and come forward a little bit more upright. So maybe I'm going back at a 45 and coming forward at a 60. That's my typical fishing cast, so I can keep the line lower over the surface. And that's probably the number one thing that you'd want to think about. Then the other thing we got to think about is, as fly casters and as fly fishers, is positioning the line and positioning the leader in such a way that we minimize drag when fishing dry flies, like making curve casts or curve mends, or perhaps a reach, or something that positions the line in a way so that we minimize drag. Because drag can be a very, very, very effective tool for spooking fish. In New Zealand, for example, if you drag a dry fly over a fish, it's gone, period. It doesn't sit around and go like, "I wonder what that was." It just disappears. I mean, you absolutely have to get them to them perfectly. But if you do, they take it right away. So the idea of being able to minimize our presence and then show the fly to the fish in such a way that we don't get line drag, the fish doesn't see the line coming in, those are the kinds of things that we want to do as anglers. So learning how to cast sidearm a little bit more. Let me give you a really good example that almost nobody I've ever heard it in any books ever seen this. And that is being able to roll cast sidearm. A lot of people, everybody roll cast, they put the rod straight up in the air and roll cast. Well, if you're a predator, you're not going to put that rod straight up in the air and roll cast. Just put it out to the side, bring it back, and make a sidearm roll cast. And that throws a line. You can put the line 6 inches over the surface with that cast. So that's a very, very effective tool for a predator because you don't have to worry about the back cast. You can just flick it out there and plus there's other things, a lot of other things that I'll deal with in the Perfect Cast 1, 2, and 3 that pertain to these kinds of things. But basically what you want to try to do is not show the line to the fish any more than absolutely necessary. Make sure if you're fishing dry flies that you position the line so that you're going to get drag-free float. And for example, I fish down and across with a dry fly rather than fishing up. Why? Because I can absolutely get that fly to the fish with zero drag on it.
Right.
First thing
right.
The fish sees is the fly rather than the line or leader. So I can get right. It to the fish without being, you know, And that's all the guys at Fish Henry's Fork, for years and years and years, that's the way they all fish it, is down and across to those big fish, not up and across.
Right, right. And it seems like the more stealthy you are, the closer you can get, then the more control you have over your cast, too. And
that's right, and the more necessity of doing that sidearm stuff, too. Much more
right,
necessity
right.
there.
You get more accurate,
yep.
have less line in the air, less rod in the air.
That's right.
Maybe even use a shorter rod, right?
That's right.
You don't need a long rod to do longer casts, that kind of thing. Yeah. A couple other questions we'll close out with here. One was, and I guess this is a general answer I'm looking for here. Tim Knight in Grand Haven, Michigan says, as a weekend fly fisherman, how can I find a way to approach fly fishing and be successful? So kind of a general, maybe your top tips for learning how to become a better fly fisher when you're first starting out.
Well, I'd say number one, get really good at being able to put the line down, casting, even out to 30 feet. You don't have to be able to cast 500 feet. You know, the first thing everybody wants to do when they get to the casting pond is throw to the other end of the pond. Oh, they never fished that far, but, you know, you've got to cast that far. Really be able to do some things with that fly rod that allow you to position the fly correctly on the water. Second thing you got to understand is how that fish is going to react to you. So this concept of the angler's predator, being just a little bit more cautious, wearing clothes that's more than natural colors, taking a little bit more time. You know, then the third thing you need to learn is how to fish, obviously, dry flies, nymphs, and streamer flies, so that you've got the capability of doing what needs to be done under a particular circumstance. Most of the time, fish are not feeding on top. So most of the time, you're fishing nymphs or you're fishing streamer flies, you know, bucktails or whatever underneath the surface. So knowing how to do each of those and knowing some of the basic techniques, you don't have to know, you know, everything. But if you know two or three basic techniques, you can always go out in the stream and manage to find a fish or two that's willing to take a fly.
A question just came in, and I'm going to have to ask you this one because I think it's really good. Henry in Wisconsin.
Henry.
You know Henry?
He's my good buddy. He said he was going to send in a
child. Rothschild, Wisconsin.
Yes.
And this is in your book, and I didn't get to ask it, but he said, since refraction works both ways, when we see a fish is not where we think it is, will you explain how we can adjust for this so our cast will be in the correct location? Very good.
Sure.
He must have read your book already, huh? Did you give him an advance copy?
Yeah. Tonight. We went to dinner with him, and he got his advance copy.
Oh,
yeah, sure. That's a great question, and it's a question that fly fishers really, especially fly fishers with predator, really need to understand.
Yes.
Because refraction bends the light going into the water, it also bends the light going out of the water. And so the fish is always deeper than it looks. The fish is always deeper. When you're 30 feet away, the fish is about three times deeper than it looks. Hmm. So if it looks like it's down there, a foot, it's down three. If you're 20 feet away, it's about twice as deep as it looks. If you're 10 feet away, it's about 1.5 times as deep as it looks. If you're standing straight above it and looking perfectly straight down, it's 1.333 times deeper than it looks. Because that's the refractive index of water, is 1.33. So as you get closer, the fish gets much closer to its real position, but it will never get to its real position. So if you're standing on a bridge looking down and it looks like the water's 3 feet deep, it's 4 feet deep. If the fish is down on the bottom, it's not 3 feet down, it's 4 feet down. Now, think about the effect this has on presenting the fly. You look out there and you see the fish and you go, okay, it's 1 foot down when it's really 3 feet down. Its window is three times bigger than you thought it was. So instead of having a window that's 2.26 feet across, it now has a window that's 7.2 feet across. And you throw your fly 5 feet above it, you're throwing it right into the window. So knowing this idea that the fish is always deeper than it looks allows you as a predator then to adapt your casting and your presentation tactics to the idea, you know, to the fact that the fish's window is bigger, that it's deeper. You cast a nymph out there and expect it to sink down in 5 seconds, but it takes 15 to sink down because the fish is three times deeper than you thought it was.
Right.
So this is a very key and very important part of what we do as anglers, as predators. And every single person that's ever fished knows this, but maybe don't know they know it. Because they've stepped in the river and thought it was only a foot and a half deep and dang near, you know, took a header because it was twice as deep as they thought it was.
Right, right.
So we've all done that. We've all stepped in and gone, whoa, water's so clear, I couldn't see the bottom. Well, it doesn't matter how clear the water is. The refractive index is 1.33, and it's always 1.33 times deeper than you think it is.
Yeah. Well, I notice that when you say that, I think about that now, because many times you look at your feet, and, you know, you just look down and look at your feet.
Right.
It looks like you got short legs, you know.
Right. Want to see something really, really funny? Look at your buddy's feet from 30 feet away. It looked like his feet come right out of the bottom of his knees if he's standing in water up the knee deep. You won't even, it's just like the feet come right out of the bottom of his knees. That's really weird.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, we got to tie things up here, Gary, and close things out. Lots of things to talk about. And
yeah, we're just getting started.
Oh, I know, I know. I think we got to page 3 in your book. Is that and what? It's a couple of hundred pages, so lots to look forward to there. Yeah. Well, we'll be right back here in just a minute. And stick with me, Gary, because I want you to be involved in giving your book away here. We're going to be giving away 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And, of course, a copy of your book, The Angler as Predator. So we'll be right back, and we'll do just that and give away these great prizes. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fly fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to this region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org. That's SaveBristolBay.org. And there you can learn more about how you can get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away some prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. So if you didn't register for tonight's show yet, it's too late now, but make sure you do it for our next show, because there's lots of great gifts that we give away. So the first, and if you are the lucky winner of one of these gifts, we'll contact you after the show by email and get the information we need so that we can get you the prize that you've won. And the first thing that we're giving away is a 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. It's a great organization to be involved with and participate in. They're doing a lot for fly fishing around the world. We have a winner in Colorado, Lanford Pritchard. Lanford Pritchard, you just won a 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So, Lanford, it pays to get on the show at the right time, doesn't it? You'll know what I mean. But anyway, congratulations, Lanford. Good to have you on tonight. And, well, you got lucky right away. Now we're going to give away a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at AmatoBooks.com. And our winner there is Walt Cole. Walt Cole, and Walt's in California. So congratulations, Walt. I know you'll enjoy that journal. And Motto Books, if you want to find out more about all the publications they have many, many books and publications, go to AmatoBooks.com. AmatoBooks.com. Okay. Now, we need to ask a question here. This is for Gary's book, his latest book, An Angler as Predator. And if you're lucky enough to win this, you'll be very happy. And if you aren't, then you need to go buy it from Gary, along with the other three books that he's published. And we do have, in Gary's bio on his speaker page, we do have a link to Gary, your eBay store, right? Is that correct?
And they can also just go on my blog, GaryBorger.com. There's information on there.
Okay, GaryBorger.com, or the link in his, which both of those links are on his speakers page. So you want to learn more about what these books are about and so forth and what's coming up, then that's the place to go is GaryBorger.com. So we're going to give this away. The question is, Mr. Brooks had a saying, and I want you to paraphrase it. It doesn't have to be exact, but what did Brooks say about fishing water? And he had a little saying that Gary shared with us. So tell me what that is, because we're all probably at fault for breaking this little rule that he came up with. So go ahead and share with us what you think that was, and we'll see if... Okay. Gary, tell me if this one's correct. It says, fish it before you wait it. Was that what
I was
looking for?
That's what we're looking for.
Anthony Scotto, I'm not sure how you pronounce your last name, Half Moon Bay, California. You just won Gary Borger's book, The Angler is Predator, so congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, he was the first answer, and he had it right. So looks like we got a bunch of more coming in here. Dean got it right. Dean Wormel, Rick, you got it. Got it right, too. So they were listening, paying attention. That's what's important. But, Anthony, you got the prize today, and thanks for playing and joining us. We appreciate you doing that. Well, Gary, really appreciate you being on the show again.
I don't know how many times
I've had you on, but looks like I'll probably have you on about 16 more times.
At least.
Because you got that many more books coming. But we always appreciate it. And I did talk to, for those of you that follow Jason, Jason and I have exchanged some email. We haven't been set down a date yet, but we're going to talk to Jason about fishing skinny water. So that was something Jason wanted to talk about. So we're going to be doing a show with the other Borger. and
that'll be great fun,
very
too.
Soon. Yeah, that'll be fun because, boy, nowadays there seems to be a lot of skinny water out there, I'll tell you. But thanks so much for being on the show. I appreciate your time and your expertise. We always do.
You're very welcome.
Our next broadcast will be on August 21st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we'll interview Ray Gould. And our topic for the show will be building bamboo fly rods. Ray has been building bamboo fly rods since 1958. So you want to join us to hear this master rod builder talk about the machines and tools necessary, selecting cane, creating precise tapers, step-by-step construction, finishing steps, and many more tips on building bamboo rods. So join us then for that show. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.